Welcome everyone to the first book club at Club Dhammaloka. Today's book is Good, Bad, Who Knows? I hope everyone has had a chance to read the book and come prepared to discuss. Our speaker today is Venerable Mataji. Venerable Mataji used to be a CEO of a charitable organisation. He has supported BSWA over the years by helping out with the legalities of running a religious organisation. His lifelong search for absolute truth started in his teens in Europe. However, he believes he only found the real teachings when he touched on Theravada Buddhism more than 10 years ago. Living and studying at Bodhayana Monastery enabled Venerable Mataji to finally find the real teachings. He then decided to ordain as a monk in his early 60s, and his name translates as victory through loving kindness. Over to you, Venerable Mataji.
Thank you.
Thank you, that was lovely. Happy New Year to everybody. And I'd like to make this an interactive session. I know the monks that are going to do the four book clubs are excited to give you as much as they can in terms of their understanding, but I think it'll work best in the philosophy of a book club that we share observations with each other of kind of what we've taken from the texts. Yeah? Anybody like me to start with a trick? Might be different. I haven't seen Ajahn Brahm do one for a while. Here's one book, Good, Bad, Who Knows? Here's another one, Don't Be Grumpy. What's the difference? They're both the same. They're both the same. This one came out a year before and was published, I think. Let's have a quick look. I think it was published overseas. And I interviewed Ajahn before he went on personal retreat. He'll be on retreat till he starts the Jhana Grove retreat next Friday. But the intention was that this be a fundraiser for the nuns, especially to keep the building work on Dharmasara going and to make sure that there were funds there in perpetuity. So one audience picked that name, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, which I can now put down, but Good, Bad, Who Knows was the one that he preferred. Basically because there's a core story in the middle of the book. And what I like about it is, in some respects, he takes one of the Buddha's teachings and brings that up to date or makes it very simple to understand. He also says that 30 years ago, or probably 35 years ago now, a Tibetan teacher said to him, do make sure that you make sure the audience is happy and joyful, and make them laugh. And when you make them laugh, they'll be more relaxed. That's the moment to drop in something profound. So to have that balance between, some write it up this way, the author's job is to articulate and inspire, to give clear meaning, but also to entertain. And he believes that people will remember more from stories, often that they may have a funny nature to them. You remember the punchline more than quoting suttas in depth, or make sure you understand this philosophical dimension. He also had great experience from about 2005. This came out in 2014. In 2005, that wonderful event happened where a lady came to the monastery and said, have you written down any of these stories? Have you done it? Because I found they were really helpful for my life when I went through a bad divorce, when I went through some medical issues. And he goes, no, I've never thought about doing that. She said, oh, great. I've been doing it. Will you have a look at my draft? So she gave him the draft, and he said, look, thanks very much. Can I make some adjustments? Can I make some changes? And about 6 weeks later, I think he was in Melbourne, and he gave a talk there, and a publisher came up to him and said, have you written any stories by any chance? Because, you know, word had got out that people really appreciate them and they can help them in difficult times. And he reached in his bag and he brought out a disc and he said, well, there's about 50 on there. Do you want to take a look? And that was the beginning of opening the door of your heart. So when I asked him, you know, did he change his style or did he do anything different? He said, well, why would you break a good process that's working? Why would you break something? And there hadn't been one of these books since Open the Door of Your Heart. He had written the classic Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond a few months after Opening the Door of Your Heart, which then became, you know, a text for lots and lots of people. When we throw it open to questions and the like, I'd really be interested in your understanding of why the term good, bad, who knows is sought. So a number of people may or may not know what he's getting at. And good, bad, who knows is in the modern culture, mainly attached to book reviews of his. But good, bad, who knows really is meant to show that our perceptions and your perceptions of others color the world in which we live. And often we choose to search for some meaning to what they are saying, but our perceptions could be wrong. Our perceptions could be confused, but the possibility always exists that you can find a positive mental state to deal whatever challenging situation you're in. How many of you have seen Ajahn give the talk about, he calls it the gong bonger, but he holds up the gong, the bong gonger, and says, what is this? If I said to you, what is a book? What are we looking at here? What's its purpose? Anything else? What else do you see? Someone's thought patterns? Yeah. Communication. So when we look back over time, we found that what ostensibly is a book has always been a method to communicate and is often somebody's perceptions of the world with an idea in mind. So initially, communication, when it was written down, was on tablets, and then it went on to forms of paper, and that's where we see the suttas written down for the first time 2,000 years ago. But to me, one of the many books have been the joy of my life because I can use this book as a first aid kit. I can sort of give it to a friend as a gift and say, look, I know you haven't been traveling very well, but I wonder if there's something in here that would sort of unlock the negativity and put you in a better place. And if I've recommended this or opening the door of your heart to others, I've tried to say to them, carry it around with you in your bag. And you can always take out a 5-minute meditation. You know, you can open it at random and see if a certain page speaks to you. What's nice of this version compared to Don't Worry, Be Grumpy is he chose to categorize each of the items in here. So there are 108. And different to that one, he then broke it down into terms that we'd all know, like metta and compassion. But he goes on and says, okay, well, if you're looking for help on kindfulness, there are 5 or 6 here at the front. Go to those. If you want some aspiration or inspiration, that there are stories related to that. So to me, you know, a first aid kit, something to lift your mood, to have with you in a coffee shop and say, look, I really want to change my state. So in that sense, I really think it's helpful as a tool to have near at hand, all week, as it were. Now, I've got a few stories to highlight. For me, in preparing for this, I kind of picked out, under those categories, which I felt was one that kind of really spoke to me. And if I might start by sharing with you the good, bad, who knows story. The good, bad, who knows story is about the king who goes into the forest and he hurts his finger, and his physician is asked to come and sort of fix it. But the finger gets infected, and after a few days, they realize that they have to cut the finger off, that the finger has got so badly inflamed that it can't be kept any longer. Sorry about this, I marked so many pages up. Sorry? 15, wonderful. That's why we're a team together. So this might be one of the few that I read out. So the king's initially concerned, is the finger going to be all right? Good, bad, who knows, replies the doctor, and they carry on hunting. Are you sure it's going to be okay? A few days later, the king says, good, bad, who knows? And the king becomes worried, but, you know, eventually they amputate it. So the king, so grateful to the incompetent doctor, locks him up in a cell. Well, doctor, how do you like that, being in jail? Being in prison, sir? Good, bad, who knows, replied the doctor with a shrug of shoulders. You're insane as well as incompetent, declares the king, and departs. A few weeks later, when the wound had healed, the king was out hunting again. Chasing an animal, he became separated from the others and became lost in the forest. Wandering in the woods, he was captured by indigenous forest people. It was their holy day, and they'd found a sacrifice for their jungle god. They tied the king to a large tree, and their priest began chanting and dancing as the forest people sharpened the sacrificial knife. The priest took the blade and was about to cut the king's throat when he shouted, stop! This man has only got 9 fingers. He's not a perfect enough specimen to sacrifice to our god. Set him free. In a few days, the king found his way back to his palace and went straight to the dungeon to say thank you to the wise doctor. I thought you were stupid saying all this good, bad, who knows nonsense. Now I know you were right. Losing my finger was good. It saved my life. It was bad of me to lock you in jail. I'm sorry. What do you mean, Sai? It was so bad to put me in jail? It was very good you put me in jail. Otherwise, I would have accompanied you on the hunt, and I would have been captured too. And I've got all my 10 fingers. So that's like the core story, yeah, that gives the book its title. How many know of the other good, bad, who knows story that's in this book? So anybody shout out what it is? Well, it's actually the next story, because the point of putting that in is to say someone in real life then goes and uses that story to deal with an issue that happened to them. So in 1977, this businessman was trying to get to Mumbai Airport to catch a plane, and the taxi driver got lost. And as the minutes ticked by, the businessman was getting more anxious and more angry that he was going to miss his flight. So he kept shouting at the driver, and the driver got more confused and more lost. So the businessman soon realized there was very little chance of catching the flight. And as they approached the international airport, he saw his flight take off. And seconds later, it crashed. And he'd been, that upset with the taxi driver saying, you're horrible, you made me miss my flight. And then when he saw the plane come down, he said, well, you're a wonderful taxi driver. You must be my friend for life. Please take a large tip. And the man told Ajahn Brahm this story. Yeah, and said it had changed his whole life. So now whenever he gets angry anymore and things aren't going to plan, he says, good, bad, who knows? You just don't know what's going to happen. Yeah? I did myself a mind map, just to keep us keep me on sort of track. So would anybody like to share one of their favorite stories? And perhaps we can get through three or four categories. And I'd like to hear from you in terms of why does the story speak to you? And have you been able to use it in your life? And did you make any changes, you know, having seen that story? Did it help your Buddhist practice? Any volunteers? Please.
I like the story on page 46, number 32, Should I, Shouldn't I?
Right. Can you just wait for the mic and then if okay. we want, if everybody's okay, we want to turn these into a series of podcasts that people can listen to them later if they want or make
Is that on?
That's yes. Great. Please. Yeah.
Sorry. So story number 32, Should I, Shouldn't I? Contemplation. And it's talking about a young woman who isn't sure whether she wants to marry someone or not. And she's told to toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. But to use the sort of visceral reaction of her intuition, her body, to whatever the result is, to actually make the to inform the decision. And I thought that was quite clever, because I know Ajahn Brahm talks about just making a decision rather than worrying about a decision, because you can waste all of your energy in trying to figure out what the right decision is, and then you've got no energy left to carry out whatever you've decided to do. So it kind of ties in with the good, bad, who knows as well. But I thought that was a very clever trick. I haven't tried it yet, but I thought that one stuck in my head. So if I'm ever ruminating about what to do in the future, to do something like that and then to go with your gut instinct rather than waste all your energy thinking about what to choose.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, I actually, a friend of mine used that on me, on my move here to Perth over 20 years ago. I had the opportunity to move here to Perth and I didn't know what to do. I was very unsure of it. And I was over at her place having dinner and we were talking about it. And all of a sudden she goes, let me just get a coin and we'll toss the coin. And we said, heads this, tails this. And I didn't actually realise it was this thing, but she tossed it and then she just grabbed me. She goes, what do you want to do? I go, go to Perth. She goes, go to Perth. And here I am 22 years later in here. It's wonderful. It was a perfect move for me, so it's great. So, yes.
Again, with the intention of what Ajahn and other Buddhist teachers had wanted to do, take something profound, make it fairly simple, be kind to yourself and be kind to other people in the decision that you make. It's not about tossing the coin. It's like when the coin seems to give you a decision, does it feel congruent inside, or it goes, actually, I don't want to do that. I will get married even though my mother says I shouldn't, you know, that type of thing. And that's a good example, I think, of taking a simple teaching and saying, okay, what's the profound element in that? And if I was to use that, even if I just wanted to do it as a test, you know, should I ring my daughter today or not? And it comes down and goes, yeah, I should ring her. She's got COVID this week. But if the energy was the other way, saying, oh, she can look after herself, you know, et cetera, you can just let it go and see what the energy comes up inside you. Please, sir.
Thank you. How do we reconcile that with Ajahn Brahm's frequent comment that when you don't know what to do, do nothing?
So in Elle's example, or the one I gave, I do want to take action. And I think it's come up that I should decide. If I don't want to do anything, I should be able to put it down, yeah? And the putting it down can come from the energy that comes up and says, my daughter's called Nicola. I bothered Nicola every day just to make she's okay, and she's kind of through the worst of COVID, so let it go. I can't do anything. She's in Sydney. She'll get good care. She knows how to look after herself. But sometimes just to put yourself in the position. And I'd say some of the answers that come best are if you say, whatever I decide, I'm going to apply the four Brahma Viharas. loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, or equanimity. When the Buddha called those divine abodes, that's the best place to live 24/7 anyway, in my experience. And if it's a confrontational issue, you best let go and put it down for now and see in a couple of days' time whether a better solution might come up. So thanks for sharing, El. A couple of other people I'd love to hear from. Do you have a favorite story? Manel, you must have one. Which one is it? We can try and help you. Oh, okay. Well, why don't I buy some time a second? And there is one story in here that isn't in Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. So if you kind of go through it, I was thinking, I've got to be careful. If I'm going to make that statement, they're very, very similar. And it's number 103, and I've rarely heard Ajahn Brahm tell it. So when you look at the categories, this one is related to loving kindness. So will you hear me tell you in full? Because I haven't heard him teach it in some time. It's called The Tree and the Child. And read along with me if you want. There was a mature tree in the forest which had a thick trunk, many big branches, and full foliage. A lonely child came to the tree to play. The child imagined he'd heard the tree say with kindness, "Come, climb up on me. Build a little playhouse up here. You may use some of the smaller branches if you like and the plentiful leaves." So the child climbed up the tree, broke off some branches, tore off some leaves, and made a secret house high in the tree. Even though that hurt the tree, it was happy to sacrifice a little to see the child having so much fun. Many long days the child would play in the treehouse, and the tree was content. When the child grew older, he stopped playing in the tree. The tree became sad. Its branches drooped and the leaves lost their shine. After a few years, the child, now a teacher, returned. The tree was overjoyed. The child, now a teenager, returned. The tree was overjoyed to see him again. The youth thought he'd heard the tree say, "Come, climb up again. Your old treehouse is still here. Mostly, I've missed you." "I'm too old for tree houses now," thought the youth. "I want to go to university, but I'm too poor." "No problem," the tree seemed to say. "Come back in a week. I'm about to make some fruit. I'll make some extra. Please harvest all the fruit you'd like and sell it to pay for your university fees." So the boy returned 7 days later. The tree was covered in luscious fruits. The boy took them all to the very last one, sold them, and made enough for 1 year's fees. The tree was very happy. The boy returned for the next 3 years, took every single fruit and sold them to cover his expenses. The tree was glad. It even seemed to try harder each year to make more fruit for its friend, even though it made the tree exhausted and increasingly sickly. When the boy graduated, he stopped coming. The tree was sad again. A few years later, the child, now a young man, returned. He had a very clear impression that the old tree was crying out of joy to see him again. "Wait a few days. Even though I'm a bit weak now, I can make you a lot of fruit to sell for your studies." "I'm not studying now," said the young man. "I've got a job. I've fallen in love and I want to get married. But we'll need a house to live in." "Not a problem," the tree seemed to say. "Come back tomorrow with a saw. Take my thick branches. They'll make strong floorboards and posts. There's even enough for the walls. Use the smaller branches and big leaves from your roof. There's plenty." Thus, the very next day, the young man took all the branches and leaves to make his house, leaving only the trunk. Even though it hurt the tree terribly, almost killing it, the tree was happy to make the huge sacrifice for someone it loved. For many years, the child never returned. The tree depended on its happy memories to keep alive. When the child came again, now a middle-aged man, the tree almost jumped out of the ground with joy. "Welcome, it's so wonderful to see you. Even the birds heard the tree this time. What can I do for you? Please let me help." "I now have children of my own," said the man, "and I want to start my own furniture business to earn enough money to give them a good life." "Wonderful," said the old tree. "Even though you may think I'm only an old stump, There's still plenty of beautiful wood in my trunk to make lots of expensive furniture. Take it. It'll make me happy if you take it all. So the man came the next day, cut down the trunk, and had enough first-grade timber to start his furniture business. And soon after, the tree died. Many years later, the child, now an old man, visited the place where the healthy tree had once stood, in which he built his tree house when he was a child, and which had always been so generous to him. All that was left were the rotting roots. The old man laid his head upon those roots to rest a while. Those roots were more comfortable than a pillow of feathers. He remembered with tears how the tree had helped him, without question, every single time he was in need, how that tree sacrificed everything for him and was happy to do so every time. And then he realized that the tree was his parents. Isn't that beautiful? It's only a couple of pages, but it encapsulates so much. And you know, it's got a beautiful punchline and goes, wow, did I thank my parents for everything, you know, that happened in my life? Was I just taking all the time? Do I take from the other monastics? Do I take from BSWA? Do I take from Ajahn Brahm? But that one story might be enough just to take someone through a whole week and says, I just want to think about that, yeah? The ending comes as a bit of a shock, but then it also makes a lot of sense. And you could dive into each piece and said, you know, how was I with my parents when I got married? When they got sick, did I tend to them? Do I need to do any reconciliation with my parents and say, you know, people exchange presents over Christmas, but a word of thanks, a simple gesture saying, you know, I remember all that you did, and almost pay them back for their generosity, even perhaps giving them this, you know, this book. Any observations? Does that help? Do people understand the way that these are written? I'm not sure whether it's in here, but I saw it somewhere else recently that Ajahn Brahm was approached, and a lady who came here quite regularly couldn't explain anything about Buddhism to her husband. She was sort of troubled that spiritual life had really helped her, and what was the best way to try and communicate with her husband? You know, could they share? It'd be nice if they could talk about the odd story once in a while. Ajahn Brahm asked the lady to explain a little bit about the relationship and the like, and he said, it's an idea, it's an intuition I've got. He said, go home, you know, with one of these books and just say to your husband, you're reading it, but say to him, don't you dare touch my book. So she did that for a while, and the husband kept saying, you know, what is he reading? What is he reading? He said, no, it's mine. Don't touch my book. And then sure enough, one day she went out to the shops and came back, and he was reading the book from beginning to end. He couldn't stop himself. He wanted to know what was in the forbidden book. And after that, he had lots of questions about how Buddhism could help your life. What was loving kindness? What's the difference between loving kindness and compassion? Yeah? So I think these make nice gifts. The ones that I've sent to my kids, they may still be virgin. They may not be opened. They're sitting there, but they'll sit there for a day that they might feel the need of going, you know, that's been gone now 5 years. What is this all about? Why is he kind of so happy, or he's very relaxed about, you know, he wants to support us, but he doesn't want to sort of tell us what to do. Did you find your favorite story? Yes. Here we go. Have you got your microphone?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sure.
My mother's shelf letting go was 65, page 94.
Yeah.
When Number 61, My Mother's Shelf Letting Go, page 94. He talks about giving his mom a kangaroo toy, a stuffed toy, and every time when he gives it to her, she collects it and there's no space on the shelves. It just reminds us of our everyday life. I've got my daughter just moved back from Darwin living with me, and she keeps telling that I've got lots of junk in the house that I need to let go of, but because she's bringing her stuff in. But I realize now that I have got a lot of things that we need to, you know, we keep accumulating stuff, and we think that by keeping them, we tend to remember them. But actually, we're supposed to let it go and be in the present moment all the time.
Can you share with people why you might find it difficult to let go? Why that particular story spoke to you?
Because over the years, I've got four kids, and all their things are still in the house, although they don't live with me anymore.
Yeah.
It just means I have a part of them with me all the time. But I guess it's now time for them to lead their own lives, and then it's for me to carry on with my own life and to pursue my spirituality or whatever, to get into learning what's been taught. I'm not very good public speaker, you can see. That's why I always avoid it.
Did you end up letting go of a few things?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get Eddie to let go now.
Making somebody else let go is not an easy...
That's right.
we all have our own sort of habits and stuff. When I was married, I got into trouble for having so many Buddhist books, and my wife then was... She called herself a radical atheist. Not just an atheist, but a radical atheist. Like, you only need one book. Why are you looking at all these other books? Yeah? And when I got the opportunity to be in Anagarika at Bodhinyana, I gave away 3,000 books in 2.5 weeks, all of a spiritual nature. I didn't realize I could have probably shipped them here, or they could have gone into our library and the like. And I do remember it was a little bit hard letting go. I did drive to some people's houses and saying, I've got a boot full of books. Would you like these? I'd like them to go to a good home and if we would use them. But I could see that stickiness of them not even to let go. It's like, oh, please, please take them. I empathize enormously. So, anybody else want to make some observations about the books? We've got about another 12 minutes. Does everybody enjoy the book? Do they find it useful? Do you recommend it to friends? Or please, we'll just get a microphone over to you. Four.
142. I have to find it. It's pretty short. Oh, that one. Yeah. Are you a human being or a human going? Equanimity. So I had just had I've had an operation that has really stopped me having to do lots of physical stuff. And I've had to really look at, I'm not allowed to lift certain weights and forever and other things, and I've sort of had to sit down and think about how much going I've done and sort of thinking, why did I do that? It's been quite revealing, and this little story here sort of made me think about it and also helps me think about it for the future. Because if I do something wrong, I may mess up my operation or mess up what the surgeon has done. And, you know, and it's just not being mindful of, I have to be more mindful. So the story, or not the story, this one, equanimity, has really made me think a lot about how much going I've done in my life with the lots of children and all that stuff. So, yeah, that impressed me, but lots of them have. But that one I quite, for now, for what I'm going through now, that's something I'm going to have to really think about. And that simple little term, human going and human being, is good for me. So.
Did you find that one in particular a comfort to you recently? Is it a comfort to you saying, I can't do as much, but, you know, this can remind me that I can just be peaceful, kind and gentle to myself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's the intention. That's sort of where I'm coming from. And it's a classic story from the Buddha. I mean, Ajahn Brahm has marked it down, you know, for equanimity.
Yeah.
But those who saw the talk last night or were here, Ajahn Brahmali was explaining why Ajahn Brahm saw the main purpose of the practice, the big thing that you should do is stop the doing. And the whole talk last night was about letting go. And he set up this debate. The Buddha says, drop the five senses. Ajahn Brahm says, don't do so much doing. There's one right and one wrong. And he's teasing the audience a little bit, saying it's the same thing coming from two different directions. And allowing yourself, you know, the stillness and the peacefulness, even when out in the world there's lots of distractions that could bring you in, or saying, oh, I've had the operation now, I should be back together immediately. No, you don't have to do that. Be peaceful, be kind, be gentle. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's a lovely story too. Just a few minutes to close. I'll have to watch the time, you know, because of the meditation on at sort of 3 o'clock. Had this book given anybody the idea to go and make your own? So this is somebody else's observations, yeah, that is to be of help. But as you heard a Buddhist teaching that was helpful, or as you had an observation in life, it dawned on me, you know, in reviewing this, you could create one yourself. And if the one you were creating spoke to yourself, you might say, okay, I want to understand loving kindness a bit more. I'm not going to dive down into sort of deep suttas. What does loving kindness mean to me? And what would it be if I applied it to myself, and what it would be to apply it to other people? So you could, if you wish, create your own, which is a personal memory that you're not going to share with somebody else, or it's something you do want to share with family and friends, or even give out as a Christmas present or a Vesak Day acknowledgement, you know, to your kids and stuff, and says, I just wrote these little stories. You know, I don't think they're much, but they kind of really helped me on my journey. So if that speaks to you, I'd encourage that. The categories that I referred to at the beginning, so if you first look at the contents page, it says what the story is, but in bold type next to it, it then breaks into whether that's a wisdom teaching, whether it's about cultivation. And in total, I think there's about 10 categories, and the categories are organized by contents just before the book starts proper. So there's lists of aspiration, compassion, contemplation. So again, a really sort of quick reference point if you are looking for a specific something on a particular day. I'll just mention a few others in closing that spoke to me. Whether we like it or not, you know, we've all had anger, and sometimes it can bubble up from a past memory or the like. So on page 7, I like the teaching number 6, anger is temporary insanity. And that really is about looking at anger and saying, please have compassion for the other person, and have some equanimity for the situation you find yourself in. This one talks about a man being asked to go down to a village market and coming across someone who's very foul-mouthed, very rude, just pursues the man who's been sent to the market around the place, calling him names. And it transpires at the end of the story that the man's wife knows that this poor man had been in a bad accident and had a blow to the head, which had made him quite disturbed and the like. So she said, will you go back and get me the cheese that you couldn't face him the first time? So to me, that's a great story. And you know, I try and remember those things if it, you know, bubbles up in my life, which it will from time to time. You know, nobody's perfect. Story number 9, the photo album about letting go, I found is really good to realize that for those of you old enough like me, you used to take pictures on a camera that was a piece of film, and you took the film to a chemist, and the chemist redeveloped that film. And the source material that the pictures were on are called negatives. And Ajahn Brahm makes the point that the photo album that we tend to keep in our head, or we access fairly quickly, is the negatives. We don't press the delete button in the photo album. We don't say, why don't I go for a positive memory night right now? You can't keep two thoughts in your same head at the same time. So the Four Foundations of Mindfulness says, go and look for something positive and use that to push the negativity away. And gradually, you know, you build that as a practice, and it becomes regular. You know how to do it, and you feel a lot better immediately. And people notice that in you, and they like to be around you more. The next quick story is for Leha and L in particular, because when we decided to get a operations manager for BSWA, I presented to the committee that there were good reasons for doing it, and there was enough reasons, I think, to satisfy any AGM. But I was concerned that people would save up all of their issues, all of their dirty stuff, for the operations manager and say, look, I'm on the committee, but now you're here, you handle it. And one of my favorite stories of all is about the nun who threw a bucket of shit over the wall, and it landed on a businessman who was going off to get a major contract with the king. And the businessman, who's now covered in urine and feces, runs around, wants to get really angry with the nuns who threw this bucket of shit. And this guard on duty says, oh, you lucky man. That's so auspicious. That's special holy water. Go home and get changed quickly, but I think this is really auspicious. You should go and see the king. I think you're going to get a really big contract. Unfortunately, he did. So he came back and thanked the nuns, except when the Buddha found out there is in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, you must not throw buckets of shit over walls. The story happened 2,500 years ago. So I deliberately said to the committee, do not save up your buckets of shit and throw them on the operations manager. Throw them on key volunteers. That actually means what we failed. We haven't got it right. And from time to time, we have to make sure that people don't get burnt out and we're working together. And there's lots to be done on sort of teamwork and looking after each other. So just want to share that. That's, you know, there's a story that I've gone and used, some would say mercilessly, but it was, you know, for good intent, and say we need to look after each other. Another quick one. I'll make this the last one because I'm sort of looking at the clock. So this actually happened to me. So it's not about me, but I didn't know of it until an incident, which I'll describe. So number 62, the 50 strokes of the cat. This is someone who comes to Ajahn Brahm and says, look, I think I've done something wrong. I need to be punished, which is what we may have been used to in Western society or from schools and the like. And there was a lady who was not particularly well, but she made some accusations about me when I was in Anagarika. And I chose to go and tell Ajahn Brahm first and said, look, I haven't done anything, but she thinks I should be punished. So, you know, what are you going to do? And I didn't get it initially, but he said, okay, you want to be punished? And she's sure that you need to be punished? Then go and find a cat, and you need 50 strokes of the cat. Go and stroke the cat. That's about as much punishment you're going to find in the monastery. Like, if you've done something wrong, go and ask for forgiveness. Put it right. Confess as you would, you know, as a bhikkhu. But I just thought that was brilliant. 50 strokes of the cat. So once in a while, if somebody goes, you know, I'm in trouble now, and you go, you haven't done anything, you know, that person, you know, we can vouch for you, we were standing next to you. Do you think you need 50 strokes of the cat? So, okay, well, that might be a good place to finish. I'm sorry if it's a bit clumsy if I do finish there. Happy to talk further at another time. There are sort of other observations, but all we're trying to do in assisting the book club is to be available to you, give my perceptions, which could be good, bad, who knows? So, but also to do this regularly for you, and if the podcasts help the library, if the podcasts help someone else somewhere in the world, we just want that, you know, as a contribution and say, this is really good stuff. It's helpful. It's really simple. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You can pick up a story and read it in a minute or two, and it might just help you out of a difficult situation. And the last thing I'd like to say before we just bow three times to the Buddha, it says good, bad, who knows, but my book review says it's only really good. Thank you very much. Just bow to the Buddha three times.